It is now my pleasure to introduce our speaker, who I know just a little bit, after 40 years. Soldier, statesman, scholar, friend.
Oh boy.
States a plaque presented to my husband, Bruce, after a one-year tour of duty in Tbilisi, in the Republic of Georgia, in the former Soviet Union. Other deployments were in Afghanistan, Liberia, Bosnia, and a second tour in Afghanistan, ending in 2008. Bruce retired from the Army as a colonel. Bruce completed a master's degree in elementary education from Oklahoma City University in 1971. He also has a master's in business administration from Webster University, completed in 1982. He has worked as an organizational effectiveness consultant for the National Guard, as well as having taught military science at Georgia State University. In public school, both in Oklahoma and Georgia, Bruce taught first grade, fourth grade, and fifth grades, as well as English for speakers of other languages. And I will tell you, it is a miracle that we are still married after he taught first grade. We have two sons, Jacob, who lives in New York City, and Jordan, who lives in Dallas, Georgia. Bruce's favorite hobby is volunteering as a whitewater raft guide and outdoor recreation trip leader at Georgia State University. And the title of his sermon today is Only the Last Cannibal Starves to Death.
Now, I sent the main idea statement to the two local newspapers for this sermon this morning, and I didn't see the one in LJ, but I did see the one in the Pickens Progress. And they got the main idea stuff all in there that I had sent them, but they left out one of the last lines, and I don't know why. It was in the little paragraph at the bottom that talked about we were having a potluck supper today, and everybody was invited and so forth. And I put a line in there that said, you might want to pass on the stew that Bruce Wood brings, given the topic of today's sermon, because the meat's indefinite and one of his neighbors is missing. And they left that out. That was my best riff. I don't know why. But they got the main idea statement. Well done. In honor of Veterans Day, our main idea this morning is that the veterans' military experience serves as a model for overcoming our country's current divisive atmosphere. Our country appears tragically divided, and that divisiveness threatens the integrity of our democracy. The macabre metaphor of the last cannibal represents the decayed spirit, moral weakness, and radical self-centeredness that underlie the knee-jerk response of viewing other citizens as enemies, at the expense of concern for the common good. Through military experience, veterans understand how a common mission, shared values, and the practice of camaraderie spur spiritual growth and build a sense of community, enabling us to harness our differences as strengths rather than as an excuse for jealous tribalism. Tribalism says, you are different, so you are bad. The veteran says, we are different, and we serve together. I got you back. So, what does the military experience of camaraderie, serving as an example for overcoming divisiveness, have to do with cannibals? The insight comes from this. I'll bet, I'm not sure about this, but I'll bet I'm one of the few people in the neighborhood who has literally worked with cannibals. That personal experience can provide insight. On a UN military mission in Liberia in 2004, after the devastating civil war that finally ousted the dictator Charles Taylor, I was the head of civil military operations for the UN military mission in Liberia. Most of Liberia was controlled by tens of thousands of armed bandits, many of them child soldiers, roaming around the country in loosely organized quasi-military gangs led by some of the most vicious, barbaric killers on the planet, some of whom practiced ritual cannibalism. They weren't cannibals because they were hungry. That old image of the naked savages sitting around the campfire, big boiling pot with a European explorer in it, you know, waiting, licking their lips. That is a wildly inaccurate racist stereotype. They used ritual cannibalism as one of many tools of terror to control civilians. Now, that's common throughout history in most cultures, but the cannibalism part is much more rare. Starvation is the most common form of mass terror that a government uses to control its citizens. But they did, some of them did indeed use ritual cannibalism. The gang would come into a village, grab the village elder, torture him to death, kill him, remove some vital organs, take a bite here and there in order to symbolize, this guy's not coming back. We're in charge now. We have taken his power. They actually removed a president like that. This was before Charles Taylor, a few presidents before that. Grabbed the guy up, the rebels grabbed the guy up, tortured him to death, paraded him around in the back of a truck in Monrovia, the capital city, stopped, took something out, took a bite, moved on, another big public gathering, took a bite, moved on, and so forth. And very effective transition of power. There was no question about who was in charge after they did that. I actually saw the videotape of the torture and the execution, not the ritual cannibalism, though. I guess the cameras weren't on then. But it happens. The bandit gangs fought each other for control of territory, hoping to be the last group standing, like the last cannibal, as the UN troops moved into the area. To execute a program planned by the UN and the new Liberian government, my job was to go out in the jungle to find the leaders of these bandit gangs and convince them to gather their fighters, let us count them, and feed them to keep them from stealing every scrap of scarce food the civilians had left. To make the plans work, the bandit leaders and I literally had to work together. That required a paradigm shift on my part. From regarding them as targets for offensive military operations, and on their part, they had to shift from seeing who will be the last cannibal standing to a slightly higher order of metaphor, as viewing each other like scorpions trapped in a bottle. That's actually a step up from where they were before. Like two scorpions in a bottle, only one survives. Normally they kill each other. That's what was going on all over the countryside, taking thousands and thousands of civilian lives with them. However, if the bottle is big enough, allowing some room to maneuver, and if the bottle has a few more bugs in it, allowing them to eat without the scorpions killing each other, maybe the scorpions can make a deal and achieve a truce. It was my job to convince them of that model, as opposed to aspiring to be just the last cannibal. They can even look to the future and let some bugs live long enough to reproduce so they can continue to eat without killing each other. Let's make a deal. They can find enough common ground for a deal, even if it's based on greed, lust for power, and mutual threat. Other paradigm shifts occurred. As we sat around the table in a filthy bar in a fetid Monrovia slum, or under the thatched roof of a shack in a burned-out jungle village, as we worked out logistics and schedules and locations and phases of operations to get food to these bandits so maybe they'll leave the citizens alone, count heads, get some names, get an idea of how many of them are out there in order to facilitate the rehabilitation and the disarmament process. I wielded none too subtle carrots and sticks, and they pressed me to clarify what was in this for them, both as individuals and for the bandit gang. They came to view me as just another scorpion in the bottle. Because we all knew, as we sat there working with each other, under other circumstances, and if this process doesn't work, we're going to be trying to kill each other. So there we talk, working out the logistics, working out the schedules, stingers raised. They often used a phrase that helped me change my attitude. They said, "We deserve consideration because we freed this country from Charles Taylor so you guys wouldn't have to." And they were right. We had 3,000 Marines in a warship off the coast of Liberia for a while. That's what convinced Charles Taylor to leave. But Taylor left. So we didn't have to come ashore. We didn't have to enter that fray. Barbaric as some of those bandit leaders were, many of those rebels were real heroes who risked everything and paid a terrible personal price to free their country and try to establish a decent democracy. I can name several I worked with. Fine, honorable people. Muhammad Kamara, Moses Jarbo, one after another, who were real heroes in getting rid of Charles Taylor. The greatest paradigm shift for me was it happened in what was left of a church, in what was left of a small isolated town, in a crowded meeting where I was explaining to the citizens how the UN programs and soldiers would protect them from the bandits who were stealing from them and terrorizing them. And I said, we would use offensive forces necessary to run those bandits back into the jungle to get them to leave the city alone. The room fell silent at my mention of the use of military force. A woman stood, looked me in the eye, and said, "These are our children." And then she sat down. Regardless of my intent, what they heard me say was that the UN was coming to free their city from the terror and tyranny of the bandits by killing those bandits if we had to. And the bandits were their children. It's not a recipe for success. So my view of those bandits changed, and my view of the mission changed. From targets of military operations to people we are called to reintegrate into a decent society. A paradigm shift and a resultant mission change. Now, I need to bring the insights from that experience home here, especially the paradigm shifts. And this is a confession. As I look at my own behavior in this atmosphere of divisiveness in our country, I find myself confronting other Americans whom I regard as adversaries, sometimes bitterly, often aggressively, and usually judgmentally. We speak past each other, not to each other, as if to a broader audience that isn't really there, trying to score debating points that don't matter. We're not even pretending to build a vision of gradual progress toward common goals for the common good. Instead, we're trying to be that last ego-driven cannibal standing, or at best, like self-centered scorpions in a bottle. We can be better than that. We are called by patriotism and by moral reasoning to be better than that. If I can find common ground with cannibals Surely I can find common ground with other Americans. I may not like some of those people, but good Lord, they're not cannibals. I personally need your help, the help from this congregation, to make the paradigm shifts necessary to work together within the broadest community of Americans as fellow sailors steering the ship of state. Let's revisit the main idea for this morning as a model for making that paradigm shift. Through military experience, veterans achieve unity in spite of society's divisive nature. Veterans understand how a common mission, shared values, and the practice of camaraderie build a sense of community, even if we don't like each other. Veterans learn from training and from experience how to harness our differences as strengths rather than as an excuse for jealous tribalism. Tribalism says, you are different, so you are bad. The veteran says, we are different, and we serve together, so I have your back. Rituals, ceremonies, and stories of military camaraderie abound in our culture and provide a starting point for finding common ground for the common good. We all know these stories. Soldiers will take a bullet for a buddy, even if they don't like each other. Greater love hath no man. We know the rest. Soldiers inspect each other's gear and equipment. We make jokes when we're doing that. You go out on patrol and people, you turn around, you inspect your buddy's gear, make sure everything works right. Certainly before you jump out of an airplane, you got to make sure that parachute's hooked up. We look like baboons grooming each other. And the spirit is similar. We're taking care of each other. A soldier does not have the individual right to have a dirty rifle. A dirty rifle jams and keeps the soldier from covering her sector of fire from the foxhole, which risks the defensive fire plan for the whole unit. Soldiers don't greedily hoard ammunition from each other. They constantly redistribute ammunition among each other during operations to make sure everyone has the resources necessary to accomplish their share of the mission. Soldiers don't learn first aid to treat their own wounds. Some rituals and habits that reinforce unity are subtle and not dramatic at all. For example, few others, if you're not in on it, people observing it don't really see this happening. They don't understand what's going on. Come to a meeting that's more formal, a dinner or some kind of by headquarters staff member meeting, and everybody's dressed up in a dress uniform. And you got stuff stuck all over this dress uniform. And there's badges and there's ribbons and there's insignia. And it shines and it's multicolored. We look like Christmas. And every one of those little badges and ribbons and whatnot is held on by a little clip we call a dammit. It's like this. But on a dress uniform, there's dozens of those dammits holding on the badges and whatnot. So you're standing there and you're talking and carrying on a conversation with other people. You're shaking hands. And you turn around and you hear click. 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 The pin fell off. On the inside of your coat, uniform coat, and you can't see it, but you know you got stuff flopping. Uniform looks stupid, and you look around and you can't find that little clip, and you say, and that's why they're called dammits. People get in the habit of bringing a few extra dammits in the pocket of your uniform, so that, and they're not for you. We don't bring them for ourselves. We bring them when somebody else is in need of a damage. And it always happens. Somebody's going to need that. So you very discreetly walk up and say, "Hey, buddy, I got you here." And you take a damage out of your pocket. And you look at it and you straighten it up and you pin it on the guy. You see, you can't pin that on yourself. You can't see it. It requires another soldier to help you get your uniform back on straight. And it's part of that grooming process. And it's a symbol of unity, a symbol of that community spirit, a symbol of camaraderie. I was going through the basement trying to clean out some stuff the other day, stumbled across the cabinet, had that old dress uniform in there. I haven't worn a dress uniform in forever. And I looked in the pocket of that dress uniform, decades old. There's a little bag of damage in it. Still there. Bag of damage. As we shift our paradigms from self-centered confrontation to productive, unity-building interaction, let's start that interaction. Let's lead with empathy as a strength instead of as a fallback position after bitter divides become apparent in interactions. We are more alike than we are different. So, let's lead the interaction with the assumption of some common values. Let's search for common ground with the assumption that common ground exists. Let's probe the initial contact with a bag of dammits. Now, what might that behavior look like? What might be the symbols and rituals that we can use to reinforce community? Let's look to our 7 UU principles as guidance. If you can't read the slide, they're in your hymnal, right after the preface and before the first hymn. And let's look at some examples of what those collaborative processes, those unity-building processes can be. All right, for example, the Thanksgiving community dinner in LJ. We're going to be working with a lot of people, many of whom we don't agree with. But we're going to work together, and we're going to pull off that Thanksgiving community dinner as we have for years. It's ecumenical. Lots of different churches with very different backgrounds working together to pull off that common act, that community activity. Which of the 7 principles does that communal behavior represent? Number 3?
Number 1.
1? That's common ground. Those are dammits. Veterans ceremonies, all the parades on Veterans Day and so forth, all kinds of people there from all kinds of backgrounds, supporting each other in that shared value of celebrating Veterans Day. Which of the 7 principles does that represent? Does that support out of a shared value represent? Specifically, name one. Somebody. Okay. Okay. That's a shared value. Charitable work like animal rescue or Habitat for Humanity building houses. God bless Jimmy Carter. Dale told me a joke the other day. I don't know where you got it. I don't remember where you got it, but it was something like this. When we heard about Carter going into the hospital to get the last brain operation that he's had on there, somebody said, "You know, if he dies, it's going to likely take him about a week to get back to building houses for other people. Which principle, which UU principle is represented by swinging a hammer for Habitat for Humanity?
Number six.
The value we all support. Our hosting of Strengthening Families, the organization of Strengthening Families. We do that. And I don't know if you've hung around the people who participate in those Strengthening Families activities, but they're not UUs. There's a great deal of difference we have with those folks in opinions about nearly everything. But here we are, serving them, helping them. And they are perfectly willing to help us. Treatment courts, within the context of the whole, you're getting broader and broader, within the context of the whole process of criminal justice reform. That's a shared value that we have with a majority of the people in this state. Which UU principle is exemplified by criminal justice reform? One, two, three. There is a great deal of common spirit, unity of spirit, in our seven principles. They work, they're useful to us precisely because they are not exclusive to us. Road cleanups. Clearly. Activities that reinforce, strengthen, and depend upon unity to succeed. An example. I don't know if any of you ever went to Oklahoma City in decades past. You ever had, nobody actually goes there. I mean, nobody went there. You pass through there on your way to someplace else, like Dalhart, Texas. But the Oklahoma City, especially the central city, when I was growing up there, it was a dump. But in the 70s, some visionaries of a broad range of backgrounds got together and went through a strategic planning process, a collaborative strategic planning process to rebuild, especially the central part of the city, and use that as a platform for rebuilding and development, the economic development of the whole city, serves as a model for the world. And now, downtown Oklahoma City, which just amazes me, having grown up there, is beautiful. It's one of the most popular cities for young people to move to in the entire country. That took decades of teamwork and leadership to build community support for that effort. Shared values, common mission. Everybody, and imagine what those initial meetings were like. Those people sitting in that room, first few sessions, they didn't like each other. But they entered the room with a bag of dammit. So why bother? Why even bother to reconcile with tribal enemies? Why not just fight it out? The motive for reconciliation and collaboration for the common good is love. And love requires a strategic long-term view. We build a better community that we will not see or live long enough to enjoy, but our grandchildren will enjoy it, and use our building of it as an example for their building of an even better community, which they will not see or live long enough to enjoy, but their grandchildren will enjoy it, and they will use their forefathers' building of it to build an even better community, relying on the strength of a loving tradition of building better communities through the ages for others to enjoy. And so civilization and humanity progress. What does it look like? What does it feel like here and now in our community as we deal with neighbors of whom we are suspicious and some of whom we don't like? What does it feel like to find common ground and then climb to even higher ground, to rise above aspiring to be that last cannibal, to climb higher than that scorpion in a bottle, to approach an enemy with respect, knowing that we cannot control that enemy's attitude toward us, but we can control our behavior toward them. And we can know that we are not damned to remain as enemies. We can pursue a strategy enabled by a paradigm shift. Scorpions in a bottle look for a vulnerability, a weakness in that opponent. But we don't have to do that. Citizens don't do that. People building the beloved community don't do that. We look for vulnerabilities in that adversary, and instead of exploiting the vulnerability to our advantage, we approach that vulnerability with a bag of dammits. We use that vulnerability as an opportunity to extend a hand, a helping hand of loving kindness, that we can ask forgiveness and we can forgive. We know that we do share some values as we share the breath of life, that we can sing and dance together in witness to our common humanity. We can choose to treat others as we want to be treated in accordance with the golden rule. We can choose to meet an even higher standard than the golden rule. And we can treat others as they want to be treated. And we can strive even higher and bond with each other to believe in each other's dreams. For such is love and such is faith on Veterans Day and every day. Thank you. Discussion. Discussion and discussion. Melody.
Bruce, thank you. I've certainly learned a lot, and I appreciate the aspirational aspect of everything you said. But I have one concern. I agree that shared values is a building block of community. But I do not see shared values under number two, justice, equity, and compassion with people who believe and approve and groups support the kidnapping of children and placing them in cages. I don't see it. And I don't personally know how to deal with this.
I didn't see it either with those cannibals until I looked for it. And it's there. The possibility for common ground is there. Shared values are there. Yeah.
As a country, and this goes back to the collaborative planning kind of thing, if you start from the beginning, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by our Creator with the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, what's wrong with starting there? And who can disagree with that?
Absolutely nothing, and most people will agree with that most of the time until you threaten them. And they'll respond to a threat with other threats. Scorpions approach each other in that bottle with raised stingers.
But we can think.
But we can think, yeah, we can think. We can look for, we can, out of faith, in shared values. We can look for those shared values, and we can approach interactions with others from that foundation of shared values. Instead of looking for the differences, look for the shared values. They're there.
Yes.
I find that just not talking about politics at all with certain people is just makes life much easier. I work in the high school, and there was one man when they, 2016 was going on, and he told me quite seriously that he would vote for Trump because Hillary Clinton was a murderess. And I turned away from him and just walked away. Yeah. And then the other day we were talking, he says, you know, we don't agree on a lot, but you're a really good person. And I said, thank you, I agree with you. You are also a very good person. And we just don't talk about things that separate us.
Yeah.
You know?
Amy.
Well, first of all, just thank you. You put a really different twist on things that I was saying and working through, but I think an important thing, and I get frustrated too, and it's hard. And honestly, I've taken a break from my podcast because I'm like, I can't do it with like two people agreeing with me. But it's not about now. We're not going to feel the effects of what we're doing.
Yeah.
That's what we have to remember. This is not about children's children and what we have to offer down the road. I mean, we are probably not going to, unfortunately, see anything. And we have to remember, this is bigger than me. This is so much bigger than how crazy annoying this human being is. You know, this is beyond us.
And we don't want to get frustrated by our inability to achieve a desired end state of justice, for example. We're not called to achieve a desired end state. We are called to build process that creates a flow of generation after generation after generation of strengthening values and building that beloved community. The job is never going to be done. National defense, for example. Are we ever going to defend this nation so thoroughly that we don't need to try to defend it anymore? No. Never. Never. Are we ever going to really defeat the terrorist threat? How long have civilized societies been fighting piracy? 3,000, 4,000 years?
Tri-millions.
Yeah. We're not in business to create a desired end state. We're in business to clarify a desired end state as a vision. And we harness the energy of the vision to create a flow in that direction. And that's the best humans can do.
Amen.
Yes.
To address Melba's concern, because I have the very same concern, if you can approach things in sort of the way Helen said, which is not to deal with people as a group, because as a group, they lose identity, they become a label. But when you deal with people one-on-one, I have very good friends here in Gilmer County who are, they call themselves libertarian, although the gentleman is a staunch reporter of Trump and dislikes any, doesn't like any kind of social programs. But as individuals, they are some of the most wonderful people you would ever meet. They would
Yes. I just quickly wanted to say that your personal experience was personal. You changed your paradigm when you heard a mother say, "This is my child." And you said, "Oh, maybe I shouldn't shoot her child. Maybe I should try to help him." And I think that only a personal experience is exactly what she's talking about. And it's difficult to move out, but you have to move in first. You have to move in first. You have to take family into consideration, those that have been horrible and you don't like. You have to take neighbors into consideration, those who've been awful and will preach to you. You will have to take neighbors that love you and are good to you. You have to do it on a one-to-one, and it will grow. But it can't grow if you only see your own.
Mike.
So thank you, Bruce. It was a very good talk. And I like the aspirational aspect of it. But I'm going to mention that as you started out, you were one of the scorpions. And if you're in a bottle of scorpions and you've got your tail down, it's going to hit his head.
Yep.
And so I guess you want to be the compassionate scorpion.
And let me say that the primary reason those bandit gang leaders were willing to deal with me, I had the guns. I had all the guns.
And I want to mention that I was there too. I was in the Marine Expeditionary Force.
Were you?
Detailed. So,
okay.
So I thought I knew you from somewhere.
Every meeting I attended with those guys, I was armed. And I made sure I wore a shoulder holster instead of the hip holster, because I wanted them to see, and that shoulder holster was a pistol that was not on safe. Carl.
I want to approach this from two opposite ends. Sue Carroll reminded me of something, a Unity Church, not Unitarian, Unity Church minister spoke at one of my Holocaust programs in Florida, and she said, "True change comes from within." So you had to have that paradigm shift in your head before anything could change. But that's on a very personal level. Then on the opposite end, I was recently talking to my family about Eisenhower and how, and you certainly would know much more about it than I do, but here he led the country through this incredible war, but when he was president, he kept us out of military action.
Yeah, he did. The only time he mobilized troops was for Little Rock. Geraldine.
I think Helen has got a clue to what we might do as our very first level of dealing with somebody who is very opposed to us, and that's do not respond in kind. If you have to turn away and walk away to keep from responding, that's the very lowest level of avoiding conflict. But the next level could be, I don't know, find the common ground and say, yeah, I know you feel like that, but here's this. And it's for your children as well as my children. So that's a little low-level thing, way to start if you have trouble dealing.
Hey. There was an interesting article in recent Atlantic where the author made a point that extremism in politics generally arises from fear. And fear arises from the sense that one is being marginalized and excluded from having a voice in the community, so to speak. But he didn't use the word community, but that's the sense of what he was saying. And so he was basically doing an analysis of our current political polarization in those terms. He was also comparing it to the U.S. in the 1850s. And he says, this current situation politically in the United States is very similar to what we had in the 1850s, although it hadn't gotten as bad as it was in the 1850s. he pointed out in Congress in the 1850s, there was frequent fistfights between political factions within Congress, and most congressmen came armed.
Yes.
They carried pistols into the chamber with. And that there were several instances where there were actual standoffs between groups on groups within the legislature. So we haven't gotten quite there yet. but essentially he said you've got to have, for a democracy to survive, you've got to have a left of center liberal party and a right of center conservative party, but not so far apart that one or the other starts becoming marginalized. And he says if you don't have those two viable factions within the community or within the country, you cannot sustain a democracy.
Thank you, Bruce, for the care and the love that you put into that presentation. We appreciate it. Please stand.